Good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
I'm Dan Proud, the spouse of our speaker today, member of Prairie UU Society. We're an organization that respects the diversity of people. We welcome those to our community who, regardless of race, creed, sexual orientation, gender, political affiliation. I'm sure there's some others I've forgotten. And I don't have the words in front of me. So. And we also welcome any of you guests who haven't been here before to come again. Every Sunday is a new experience. We have a part-time minister who speaks on some Sundays. Sometimes we have members who are speaking, and we have outside speakers as well. Am I reading the opening words? Okay, so Robin will read the opening words.
They're from our subject, Louisa Adams. Popular governments are peculiarly liable to factions, to cabals, to intrigue. The people may often be deceived for a time by some fair-speaking demagogue, but they will never be deceived for long. So our chalice lighting is a responsive reading. It's in the back. Number 579. Someone who's been getting a lot of attention lately, Frederick Douglass. So I'll read the plain text and you'll read the italics. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are people who want crops without plowing up the ground.
They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its waters.
This struggle may be a moral one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle.
Power concedes nothing without a demand. It never did, and it never will.
Find out what people will submit to, and you have found out the exact amount of injustice which will be imposed upon them.
The limits of tyrants are prescribed by the endurance of those whom they oppress.
And now we invite the young, or young to come up for a story for all ages.
Good morning.
So, who knows what our Prairie UU is, the name of our church? Who knows what the UU stands for? It's quite a long name because two different groups got together at one point, to the Unitarians and Universalists. So sometimes we like to learn about people who were members of those churches a long time ago, and this is the one I'll be talking about today. Louisa Adams was a first lady, and so what does that mean when somebody's first lady? So the wife of a leader, or in this country, of a president. We almost got to find out what the husband of a president would be called. I think that would have been very interesting. Someday we'll have that. So this was about 200 years ago that this lady, Louisa, lived, and she actually grew up in England and France. And just to give us an idea of a couple things here, what it was like being a little girl then. Here's the kind of dress she might have worn when she was dressed up. And then later on, this is the sort of dress that ladies were wearing. Very fancy.
Fancy smanchy.
Yep. And then she met this young man named John Quincy Adams, who she married. And he was someone who traveled all over. He was sent by President George Washington first, and by later presidents, to different countries in Europe. And we've got a map here. So first, when she met him, they were in England, and then they decided to get married, and the American government said, next you're going to Portugal. So they had all their things shipped there, and then they said, no, we changed your mind, you're going to Germany. So they went to Germany and were there for a while, and then went back to the United States. Then they said, we're sending you to Russia. So 200 years ago, did they have airplanes to make these trips? How about trains? Cars? Bicycles? No. So they did have ships to cross the ocean, but they were only by sailing. So it could take as long as 50 or 60 days to get from, say, New York over to London. And it could take a really long time to get across land. So what did they use to travel on land then? Their feet, yeah, or horses.
Horse-drawn carriage.
Or here's a carriage, right? But this would take a really long time. So one of the things that happened with Louisa was she and her husband and their son were in Russia, and he was asked by the president to go over to Belgium to work on a peace treaty. It was the end of a war called the War of 1812. And he thought he would be going back to Russia, but while he was there, they said, "Nope, we're sending you to England next, to London." So he sent a letter to his wife saying, "Come and join me." Well, it wasn't quite that easy. It was February, or it was winter time. Winter in Russia is at least as cold and snowy as in Wisconsin. So she had to sell everything and get a really big carriage, and then they had to put skis on the bottom of the carriage so they could go over the snow. And the carriage was not heated. So the thing they used to do things like at night, they would heat up bricks or stones to be hot so they could put them by their feet, but after a while that wouldn't work, and they probably had fur blankets. So it was just the Louisa, her 8-year-old son, they had 2 manservants and 1 nanny, and they had to travel across Russia. There really weren't roads then, or if there were, they were just dirt. It was winter, and they had some food. The food kept freezing because it was so cold, and this took them about, it took them over 30 days to get all the way to across Russia, Austria, and so on. And this was just after a war, so sometimes they were just following soldiers that were leaving the area. It was very dramatic. So that was one of the things that she did in her life before she came back and was the wife of the president. So sometimes it's interesting to know about what people did in the old days and how much harder it was to do a lot of those things. So that's what I'm going to be talking about today, and that's our story.
Well, I'm pleased this morning to introduce our speaker, Robin Proud. Robin has spoken several times at Prairie. She's also a speaker at the Sauk City Congregation. And her area of interest and expertise by now is UU women through the years, many of whom we never knew before. And today, this will be Louisa Adams. And I thought I would mention a couple things about Robin that you may not know. She's a graduate of Carleton College, where she and I met originally through our folk dancing activities. And let's see, she's a longtime member of the Toastmasters organization, and has been involved with in the telecommunications industry for a long time. She loves to talk on the telephone. And she was a French major in school and is bilingual, and that's one of the aspects of her job. She speaks French to Quebec residents for John Deere Financial. So we're happy to have Robin today again.
All right, thanks everybody for getting up an hour earlier. People felt the president just didn't understand their concerns. He had a Harvard education and spoke like a professor. He had all these ideas for federal programs that seemed like encroachments to the rural population. He wasn't able to get his ideas passed since Congress refused to work with him. They even questioned whether his election was legitimate. It didn't help that he never enjoyed socializing with congressmen. When a populist began campaigning with down-to-earth language and dramatic style, the country turned to the outsider. The year was not 2016, but 1824. The president was John Quincy Adams, and his challenger was Andrew Jackson. So a couple caveats here. One is that, as Barbara Chatterton knows, the people locally do pronounce the town and the family Quincy, like a Z, but I'll be sticking to the more common pronunciation that we seem to have taken over. And the other one is that, of course, as a religious institution, we would not be making any specific comments on political figures. I'm talking about history, so any resemblance to anything currently happening is totally coincidental. About a year ago, this book came out, Louisa, The Extraordinary Life of Mrs. Adams. And I thought, this is right up my alley. As some of you know, I've given a series of talks. Sometimes I call it famous UU women we've never heard of. And some of them we maybe not have not heard of, like Margaret Fuller or Lydia Maria Child. Some we have heard of, but we don't know their real story, like Louisa May Alcott or Julia Ward Howe. So I kind of set that aside. I thought, well, this is sort of interesting, but maybe people would like to hear about something else. But when the events of this year happened, Louisa Adams' name started popping up. She shows up in parentheses all the time as the other foreign-born first lady. And so the more I researched the lives of Louisa and John Quincy Adams, the more I was struck with parallels. So we'll come back to 1824, but first we'll learn about our principal characters. Louisa's father, Joshua Johnson, was an American patriot who had moved to England for his merchant trade. Louisa's mother was an Englishwoman, and they were living in London when the Revolutionary War began. That wasn't a good place for an American at the time, so they moved to France. That's where Louisa mostly grew up. She was born in 1775. So one could truly say, as the song from Hamilton goes, that she would come of age with our young nation. But as we'll see, she was an ocean away and would not set foot in this new country for some time. Louisa and her sisters attended a Catholic boarding school. Her view of religion stemmed from that time. Later, she was an Anglican, and she actually never identified as Unitarian. So I'm cheating a bit by talking about her. However, her husband, John Quincy Adams, and her in-laws, John and Abigail Adams, were some of the most famous Unitarians of the time, and I'll be speaking, in a sense, about them as well. In 1795, Louisa was 20. Her family had moved back to England. That's when she met this young man, John Quincy Adams. John Quincy also grew up with the Revolution. He was 9 when his mother, Abigail Adams, took him to watch the Battle of Bunker Hill. Except maybe for George and Martha Washington, John and Abigail Adams were the most striking example of a patriot couple. They dedicated their lives to securing and building a new nation. Their version of Unitarianism was in a puritanical vein. They valued honor, duty, industry, thrift, and sobriety. They took very seriously their role of leaders in the patriotic experiment of a new country. Their way of expressing their love to their children was to deliver lectures and write letters stressing the importance of their core values. And in his turn, John Quincy was to treat his own children the same way. For instance, Abigail wrote to her son, John Quincy Adams, "Justice, humanity, and benevolence are the duties you owe to society in general. To your country, the additional obligation of sacrificing ease, pleasure, wealth, and life itself for its defense and security." Johnny, as he was called, was 13 years old when he received that admonition. He had already internalized his family's expectations, as we could tell from his journals. Fortunately for history, John Quincy kept a journal from the age of 12 until just before his death in his 80s. He often bemoaned his laziness, yet he accomplished more than almost anyone in his era. When he met Louisa, John Quincy was 28 and already had a diplomatic career. He was only 11 when he accompanied his father, who was at that time envoy to France. At 14, he traveled with Francis Dana as secretary on a mission to St. Petersburg. Afterwards, he attended Leiden University in Holland. He traveled through Scandinavia. He returned to the United States in time to graduate from Harvard at age 20. At 26, he was appointed ambassador to the Netherlands by President George Washington. He was also assigned to work with John Jay in London on a treaty, and it was at that time that he met his future wife. Because of his travels, John Quincy had spent most of his time with older adults or in private reading and study. He was captivated by the charm of the Johnson household with its music, games, and laughing girls.
He went there almost every day, and he soon made his preference for the middle sister clear. But it seems neither of them was sure about committing to marriage. After 6 months, Louisa's mother, Catherine, went to see John Quincy and demanded to know his intentions. He declared his suit, but he said he needed to finish his work in the Netherlands and wanted to delay a wedding. It was over a year before they saw each other again, and at that time, they got married mainly because of two unrelated events. Adams had been named ambassador to Portugal, and Louisa's family had decided to move back to America. After Adams' possessions had all been shipped to Lisbon, including his treasured books, he was informed he would instead be ambassador to Berlin. And at the same time, the Johnson family suddenly moved up their departure and admitted to the newlyweds that they were broke and in debt. They were fleeing their creditors. The promised dowry and even payment for wedding expenses never materialized, and debt collectors besieged the new couple. Back in America, John and Abigail Adams were unhappy with the news of a daughter-in-law who was half foreign and who seemed to have decadent European tastes. Almost as soon as they arrived in Berlin, Louisa, lonely without her parents and sisters, suffered a painful miscarriage with a long recovery. Then she had to learn court protocol and attend numerous social events. John Quincy, with his New England background, was never comfortable with the gambling, flirting, and carousing of courts. This decadence was one of the qualities the American revolutionaries associated with unjust royal regimes. Louisa enjoyed the parties and dancing, but she often had health issues. Within the year, she suffered another miscarriage. Indeed, she seems to have had a total of 4 miscarriages between 1797 and 1800. She was often ill during her pregnancies as well. The medical procedures of the time probably didn't help, such as bleeding when she may have been anemic to start with. People remarked on her pallor, so Louisa wished to wear rouge as other ladies did, but John Quincy was horrified and forced her to remove it. Finally, in 1801, a healthy child was born and they named him George Washington Adams. After the birth, however, Louisa herself was so ill that the couple's scheduled departure for America was delayed. In 1801, she finally arrived in the American continent. Louisa's family was there, but they were still struggling financially. And Louisa braced herself to meet her in-laws. Louisa found the Adams home plain and cold, while Abigail found her daughter-in-law's wardrobe and manners too frivolous. However, according to Louisa, John Adams, her father-in-law, took a fancy to her from the start. Now Louisa had to adapt to a new culture, running a household, managing servants, and when money was short, doing domestic chores herself. And that's something that comes up with all of these women. No one asked John Adams to do the domestic chores, or John Quincy, right? In 1803, John Quincy was appointed senator from Massachusetts, so he, Louisa, toddler George and a new baby John moved to the swamps that were slowly becoming Washington, D.C. Louisa said it was a scene of utter desolation. Along with the rest of her husband's family, she had a strong dislike of President Thomas Jefferson. John Adams and Jefferson had long been leaders of opposing factions. Louisa at first had trouble adapting to the social demands of the capital. In Europe, distinctions were clear. They had titles. In Washington, the theory was of egalitarianism, but in fact, there were unspoken rules and customs. Louisa wasn't happy in Washington, but she wasn't happy either when John Quincy announced at the end of the summer break when they had gone back to Massachusetts that he would return to the capital alone. So at that time, federal business would shut down in the summer. But he said it was too expensive to maintain a home in Washington for her and the children. The next year, there was a new configuration. John Quincy and Louisa went to Washington, D.C., leaving the boys with their grandparents. The following summer, he went north, leaving her alone, dealing with a pregnancy and a stillbirth. At one point, she wrote, "I can neither live with you or without you." And as you might see from this comment, the relationship between John Quincy and Louisa was complicated. They often wrote about how they missed each other. But their letters also showed disagreements, misunderstandings, and hurt feelings. John Quincy was a perfectionist about behavior, his own, his wife's, and his children's. This was difficult for Louisa to live up to, and as we shall see, it was impossible for his sons. In 1809, Adams was appointed minister to Russia. This made sense because he had actually traveled there before. He decided he would take Louisa, unlike his father. His father, John Adams, had been ambassador in several countries, but had always left Abigail home to manage the farm and businesses. So Louisa was going, but they would only take their youngest child, at this time, two-year-old Charles. So they left George and John in Massachusetts with their grandparents. It seems from correspondence that Louisa's wishes were not consulted or honored in this decision. She was to be separated from her boys for 6 years. The sea voyage to St. Petersburg took 80 days, and the ship was stopped numerous times on the Atlantic where the Napoleonic Wars were raging. America was supposedly neutral at that time. The couple found life in St. Petersburg expensive. They were expected to maintain a home and entertain and dress elegantly. Louisa made up excuses such as that she was in mourning for a relative in order to wear the same dress more than once. Yet when she did spend anything, John Quincy reproached her. In 1812, war broke out between England and the United States at the same time that Napoleon was advancing on Russia. More important for Louisa, after an additional miscarriage her first year in Russia, she gave birth to a daughter named after her. She was the darling of both her parents, but at a year old, she contracted dysentery, and after weeks of illness, suffering, and fruitless treatments, she died. The baby's mother, Louisa, wrote, "My heart is buried in her grave, and my greatest longing is to be laid beside her." And her father, John Quincy, was likewise stricken. He could find little interest in the progress of the war, even though Moscow had already fallen. But he had his work. He was chosen to be part of a peace commission to end the War of 1812. He left for Ghent in Belgium, thinking he would return in a few months. But at the end of the negotiations, he was named minister to Great Britain, and that's when he wrote to Louisa to meet him in Paris. Well, Louisa had gained some skill in running a household, especially during John's absence. Well, now she had to sell most of their belongings, pack up the rest, and set up this large carriage that could travel on runners through the snow. She had the nursemaid, two manservants, and her eight-year-old Charles. She had to cross 2,000 miles of largely uninhabited land. She set out in February in the wake of retreating French and Russian soldiers. And as they traveled, I didn't bring this up too much with the children, but there were dead soldiers, animals, people retreating. The trip took 40 days in the cold and dark. They stayed in whatever type of inn was available. Her money was stolen, but they persevered. When she finally crossed into France, she found she needed to brandish her American passport and cry "Vive Napoleon" in the towns she traversed. Interestingly, this woman, who was so often ill and overwhelmed in society, remained strong and in command through the entire trip. The couple went on to London and reunited with their sons. They were now 14 and 12. And they took up their rounds of diplomacy. James Monroe was elected president in 1816, and he appointed John Quincy Adams as Secretary of State. This was an excellent fit, as no one had the international experience of John Quincy Adams. And at that time, Secretary of State was the most common stepping stone to the presidency. When they sailed for the United States, Louisa was 42 and once more pregnant. On the ship, she was unwell, and she wrote that she suffered a bad miscarriage at sea. Washington, D.C. had been built up since the Adamses had last been there, but it had also been partially burnt in the War of 1812. Social customs had also changed. John Quincy and Louisa were expected to call on hundreds of senators, congressmen, and other notables. Perhaps out of principle, or perhaps due to Louisa's health, they decided they would return visits to anyone who visited them, but they did not intend to make all those so-called first visits. The senators' wives were scandalized and boycotted Louisa's parties. The president's wife, Elizabeth Monroe, summoned Louisa to admonish her. John Quincy was surprised that this affected him as well. Indeed, he wrote, "I could hardly have imagined that a man's interest could be so dependent on his wife's manners." And in addition, there was still suspicion about Louisa as a European. Louisa's years abroad had matured her and given her confidence. When she was engaged to John Quincy, her first letters talked about what a bad letter writer she was. But with all those years of travel, she was constantly writing to family, friends, and acquaintances. At this time, she took over writing to John Quincy's parents. They had actually come to appreciate Louisa over the years because of their correspondence and their mutual support during family tragedies. When Abigail Adams died in 1818, Louisa wrote fondly and with great praise about her. Now, at this time, campaigning or electioneering was considered gauche and corrupt. Politicians, including John Adams and John Quincy Adams, maintained the fiction that they were not running for office and would only serve if the public demanded it. But the wives could campaign in the sense of hosting parties for all the important men. Although they never had much money, Louisa became known for her parties. To economize, she made over dresses from Paris to fit the new styles. After Abigail's death, widower John and daughter-in-law Louisa wrote frequently, and one of the topics was Unitarianism. Although she never officially took on that religion, she wanted to learn about it. John had always corresponded with his wife Abigail during the many times he was away from home, and although no one could replace that dearest friend, as he called her, he greatly enjoyed Louisa's letters. John Quincy was constantly busy as Secretary of State, but Louisa wrote to her father-in-law and to her boys, often about books. She had become an avid reader. She devoured political science, philosophy, and history, as well as fiction. She read and admired Mary Wollstonecraft's A Vindication of the Rights of Women, possibly the first feminist book. As the boys grew up, their parents' concern for them grew as well. George, the oldest, was sensitive and moody. John Quincy found George's mediocre class rank at Harvard unacceptable. Second son, John, did even worse. And third son, Charles, failed his entrance exams. John Quincy ordered the boys to spend the summer studying. He refused to let the younger boys come to visit their mother over their break. Louisa was heartbroken, but as usual, the decision was made in spite of her wishes. Politically, the situation was also discouraging. John Quincy was actually the one who wrote what would be known as the Monroe Doctrine. He had facilitated the purchase of Florida, and he backed expanding the American territory all the way to the Pacific. He had worked on the most important treaties of the century, but his fellow cabinet members were rivals for the presidency, especially William Crawford and John C. Calhoun. They both resented and attacked Adams regularly in the press. By the beginning of 1824, there were five main candidates for president: John Quincy Adams, Henry Clay of Kentucky, John Calhoun of South Carolina, William Crawford of Georgia, and Andrew Jackson of Tennessee. So here's something from this biography. So this came out last year, was obviously written a year or so before that, but this is the purely coincidental part. Jackson was a force that no one, not least himself, could control. The movement to make Jackson president hadn't been serious at first. In the summer of 1823, an anonymous pamphlet appeared, that's the equivalent of the internet, right? Extolling his virtue, arguing that he was the only man to rid Washington of corruption. The other candidates weren't sure what to make of him. Never before had a serious candidate arrived in Washington with such a scanty record. And before this, presidential candidates had been from New England or Virginia. Never before had a candidate ridden a wave of such popular appeal. He appealed to men who had been terribly affected by the economic panic of 1819. Those voters distrusted Washington. They were drawn to the outsider. And Louisa wrote, "Every day brings forth a new rumor, not one of which can be believed or relied on." John Quincy was the ultimate insider. He was the son of a president, and his whole life had been spent in government service. And he had nothing of Jackson's charisma or popular appeal. But John Quincy thought Jackson would make a good running mate. At this time, the political parties were not set up as they are now. So he thought of having him as a vice president. He suggested to Louisa that they give a ball in honor of Andrew Jackson. This was the event of the year, with over 1,000 invitations. The National Republican newspaper printed a poem listing some of the many eminent guests, such as Webster and Hamilton. Each stanza ended something like this: "Belles and matrons, maids and madams, all are gone to Mrs. Adams." The ball was a great success, but Jackson did not want to settle for second place. After this bitter campaign, the election was finally over and nothing was decided. Jackson won the popular vote and the most electoral votes, but not a majority as the Constitution required. With the five candidates, the electoral votes were split. Under the 12th Amendment, the decision went to the House of Representatives. Henry Clay had one of the lower numbers of votes with 37 electoral votes, so he was out of the running, but he apparently understood his power. He met with John Quincy. John Quincy Adams was a man of high moral fiber who wrote this journal, as we know. He uncharacteristically left a blank page in his diary that night. So no one knows what went on in the room where it happened, but what we know is that Clay threw his support to Adams. That was enough for John Quincy Adams to become president, and he appointed Clay Secretary of State. Adams always claimed that there was no bargain, but Jackson and his supporters cried out about this so-called corrupt bargain for the whole of Adams' term. They constantly questioned the legitimacy of his presidency. This encouraged Congress to block the president's initiatives. He had a lot of ideas for infrastructure and scientific advancement. He wanted to have federally supported roads, canals, observatories, and a federal university. Congress also didn't agree with Adams' desire for leniency toward Native Americans. Louisa was disappointed to find the White House largely in disrepair, and as a First Lady, she could no longer escape the summer heat. She instead devoted herself to writing her memoirs. She wrote fondly of her childhood, but bitterly about her married life. She and her husband both over the years questioned whether theirs had been a good match. When her father-in-law, John Adams, died on July 4, 1826, the same day as his rival, Thomas Jefferson, Louisa thought John Quincy would have an inheritance, but the terms of the will required him to buy out other family members, which he could barely do. And after her father's experience, Louisa had a horror of debt. So this did not end up helping them out at all. In addition, Louisa's sons seemed to have inherited a weakness from Abigail's family of alcoholism. George, the firstborn, who they thought would be the next generation of American leader, was an indifferent student, distracted by parties, women, and drink. In 1828, Andrew Jackson got his chance for a rematch. He had never forgiven what he felt was a stolen election. He ran a blistering campaign against Adams. Adams was still uncomfortable about electioneering himself. But lest you think negative campaigning is a new phenomenon, there were certainly other parties out there. Some anti-Jackson factions spread a story that Jackson's wife, Rachel, was a bigamist. When she died shortly after the election, Jackson blamed those reports. Of course, Jackson was considered a war hero. He won easily with support from the West and South. John Quincy and Louisa refused to attend the inauguration. They stayed in the Washington, D.C. area, and Louisa asked her son, George, to join them that spring. They expected him on May 2nd, but instead they had a visitor announcing that George had disappeared from his steamship before dawn, leaving his hat and coat on deck. He had either fallen or jumped. His corpse was found a month later. The whole family was grief-stricken, but Louisa was especially distraught at losing another child. Sometimes she blamed herself for having urged him to travel. Husband and wife grew closer in their sorrow. John Quincy went to Massachusetts to clear up George's affairs. He found out, not surprisingly, that George had debts, but also that he had had a child with a chambermaid. It seems that Louisa was never told about this last indignity. In the spring of 1830, the remaining family went back to Quincy. They thought for good. However, by fall of that year, John Quincy Adams had been asked to stand for Congress, and he won overwhelmingly. Louisa raged at his demand that she move back to the capital. She spoke about her rights and her happiness, but in the end, she gave in largely because they couldn't afford to keep up two houses. In Washington, they lived with their son John and his family. The grandchildren were a delight, but John himself was succumbing to the family curse. By 29, he was seriously ill with various symptoms that were actually the result of alcoholism, and he died at the age of 31. So after at least 10 pregnancies and 4 live births, Louisa had only one child left, her youngest, Charles Francis Adams. Fortunately, he would go on to become an eminent historian and a politician. He was even nominated during Louisa's lifetime for president on the ticket of the Free Soil Party. Louisa turned herself again to writing to give purpose to her life. She wrote up the dramatic European journey across Russia. In spite of all her suffering, she saw she had accomplished something no other woman had. She wrote, "Under all circumstances, we must never desert ourselves." Louisa did not regularly visit the capital, but she happened to be there on February 6, 1837, when John Quincy introduced what he called a petition from 9 ladies of Fredericksburg. Congress was under a gag rule that prohibited any discussion of slavery. But in the guise of a petition from citizens, which was allowed, Adams read a demand to prohibit the slave trade in Washington, D.C. The Southern members of the House erupted in shouts, "Censure him, expel him, burn that petition." In spite of this hostility, John Quincy continued to introduce petitions to restrict slavery. It was during this time that he defended the slaves who had taken over the ship Amistad. And it's because of that that I chose the last hymn that we're going to have. At 70, Adams was the oldest member of the House, yet he endured marathon sessions and could speak for hours. Although her family members had owned slaves, Louisa backed him in his desire for abolition. She also started to speak up on a cause that was just beginning to be discussed, women's rights. She admired the Grimke sisters, who championed both abolition and women's suffrage. And she remembered the genius of Abigail Adams. She wrote to her son, "I cannot believe that there is any inferiority in the sexes as far as mind and intellect are concerned." At 81, John Quincy, who had already recovered from his one stroke and returned to the Capitol, collapsed on the floor of Congress and died a few days later. Louisa herself suffered a stroke 3 weeks later and lived in a diminished state of health another 3 years. Louisa and John Quincy spanned the entire first section of American history. He saw a revolutionary battle and governed with George Washington. When he was an elderly congressman, he came to know a young associate from Illinois named Abraham Lincoln. John Quincy and Louisa knew the struggles of creating the new country and also the rising tensions that would tear it apart. At times, they both regretted their marriage, but it endured over 50 years. And there I think of that first hymn where it says, "Disappointment pierced me through, still I kept on loving you." It may have been that they could never afford to split up, but they outlasted separations, deaths, illness, and politics. Louisa Catherine Johnson Adams, a self-taught, half-English woman, traveled the world and influenced the American political circles of her day. I'll end with a quote from Abigail Adams. She wrote to her son, John Quincy, "It is not in the still calm of life or the repose of a Pacific station that great characters are formed. The habits of a vigorous mind are formed in contending with difficulties." So I hope this has introduced you to one of our founding mothers and reminded you that nothing about human nature and its political expression is really new. The names and the forms may change, but we are always called, as our earlier reading said, to fight against injustice and for freedom. Always, her family was always struggling with money issues too, but yes, she did have the support of her family. In fact, one of her sisters actually accompanied them to Russia, and the Tsar seemed was very fond of her. So that was a whole other little side story that I didn't bring in. Yes, apparently in some of the autobiographical things that she wrote about her unhappiness with her marriage. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that she intended those for publication at the time, but mm-hmm. she did express her unhappiness. And it was difficult because her husband was saying, well, it's my duty, it's the country, right? You must sacrifice. The one I always wonder, I love to listen to audiobooks, and in fact, one of them I listened to was a biography of John Quincy Adams. But I wondered at what point the Americans would have sounded different from the British. When you see historical dramas, they usually have John Adams or George Washington having an American accent. Well, they probably didn't, right? And that's why, of course, people from Boston still sound English, or people in some parts of Canada still sound like they have an English accent to us. But I recommend this book, which is widely available. I saw it because it was on the front page of the New York Times Book Review about a year ago, so this is definitely available. Louisa, The Extraordinary Life of Mrs. Adams. It's very readable and does have quite a lot from the original sources. So I don't have one right offhand, but all right. And then since we have just a minute here, for some reason I find it heartening that even in the days of our founding fathers, all was not sweetness and light. And you see that, of course, if you have read about Hamilton or any of our founders, some of his bitter debates. And there's one I have to throw in here then that was actually got from Chernow's biography of Hamilton. When John Quincy met Louisa, it was because he had gone to Holland and England. He was assisting John Jay with a treaty. And the treaty had to do with shipping between England and America, trade agreements. Hamilton and Washington thought the most important thing was to have peace because they really did not have a navy and army in place yet to fight another war. But some of the other groups were very concerned that too much was being given away. So when Jay came back with this treaty, there was a huge outcry. People were very angry with him. He was burned in effigy. And there was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. So here's what somebody did. It was exactly the same thing. Someone went to a barn near where John Jay lived and wrote in big letters on the barn, "Goddamn John Jay. Goddamn anyone who doesn't damn John Jay. Goddamn anyone who doesn't keep his light on all night to stay up damning John Jay." So I love that. It's exactly the same impulse that sends people to the internet or to Twitter today was always there. All right. And our closing words from Barbara Peskin. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their vision, we too dream. Let us go remembering to praise, to live in the moment, to love mightily, to bow to the mystery. And join us for coffee, and we have our Just Bakery sale as well.